There's some hope from the left Texas could go blue in the presidential election, and some likelihood it could when it comes to the state house. Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. The divisive state of politics right now has many concerned about the risk of violence on or after Election Day. We'll dig into news Texas Army National Guard troops will be deployed. Plus, misinformation going out before an election is nothing new, but evidence it's targeting Spanish-speaking communities. Also, when counties can turn any building into a polling place, it often means many of those buildings won't be fully accessible. And a small-town Texas story getting its shot on the big screen. Those stories and more today on the Texas Standard. You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. It's Tuesday, October 27th, and that cold front we were talking about yesterday? Yeah, if you didn't feel it this time Monday, you probably do now. Cold is one thing, but the Panhandle and pretty much all of West Texas are seeing ice storm, winter storm, freeze, and winter weather advisories and warnings today. In comparison, it's a downright balmy high of 65 in Washington, D.C. today, where Judge Amy Coney Barrett just needs to take a judicial oath to complement last night's constitutional oath and assume the title of Supreme Court Justice. President Trump and Senate Republicans declaring this a huge victory, Democrats continuing to cry foul. How do the American people feel? Numbers that we'll start to see exactly 1 week from today could give us an idea. But first, to some other numbers. The very concerning rise in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations in parts of Texas. Both are at levels not seen since August, that according to the Texas Tribune. The only category not up at the moment, COVID-19-related deaths. Though we know that tragic indicator is the last to rise after a bump in cases. On Monday, we focused on El Paso, where El Paso Matters CEO Bob Moore says one in every six COVID-19 hospitalizations in Texas is happening. Another place of concern right now is Lubbock. Lubbock's trauma service region on Sunday hit seven straight days of COVID-19 patients, exceeding 15% of total hospitalizations. Under a state order, the region will now enforce rolling back reopenings. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick reports on what's next for the area.
As newly confirmed COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations climb in Lubbock, the leader of the county says he hopes to not have to add further restrictions to mitigate the spread of the virus. Under a statewide executive order, businesses operating at 75% capacity will go back to 50%. Bars will close, and elective medical procedures will temporarily stop. Lubbock County Judge Curtis Parrish says he doesn't want to end up like El Paso, where local leaders have enacted a curfew and other measures in hopes of reducing maxed out hospital capacity.
They're taking draconian measures in order to combat their problem. I mean, they're talking about curfews. They're talking about fines for not wearing a mask. They're taking extreme measures. I don't want us to get to that point.
The region will have to see another seven straight days of COVID-19 hospitalizations under 15% of all patients to get out from the state's rules. I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
Here we are, a week out from the 2020 election. Across the nation, of course, all eyes are on who will occupy the White House come January. And on the congressional side, Democrats seem more confident that they could gain control of both chambers, keeping the U.S. House and gaining a majority in the Senate. Here at home, the color battle is over the Texas House. Republicans currently have an 8-seat advantage, but Democrats from within Texas and around the country have been pouring a lot of sweat and a lot of money in to help flip enough seats to take over the majority. Some have asked if Democrats could do it, but Texas Tribune executive editor and co-founder Ross Ramsey has asked, what if there's a tie? Ross, good to talk with you again.
Hi, good to hear from you.
So the Texas House has 150 members. That could be an even split. Has that happened before?
No, it almost happened in 2008. There was a recount in a race in Irving, and if 23 votes had gone the other way, we would have had 75 Democrats and 75 Republicans, and you know, probably would have had a bunch of members sweating and swearing over their politics and all the reporters salivating.
Now, I mean, this 150 number, it is, it could be an even split. It seems like a lot of chambers have it so that that can't be possible. I guess a long time ago in Texas, we ended up with 150.
Yeah, and it's just never happened. You know, for years and years, the Texas House was Democrats, and you had to figure out whether you were looking at a liberal or a conservative. And then for a few years, it was Republicans, and you had to figure out whether you were looking at a conservative or a moderate. And now we've got this fairly even split and the possibility that you could land the tennis ball right on top of the net. In other bodies, like the U.S. Senate, you can get a tie, but you've got a vice president to break ties. In the Texas House, there's not a tiebreaker.
So what are the spoils of the majority team? I guess possibly having the upper hand on votes, but also getting to pick the Speaker of the House?
Yeah, the first one is picking the Speaker of the House. And in some ways, that's the most important because the Speaker chooses who will be on which committees and who will head those committees. All the power derives from that election. So the first thing that happens is the House comes in, they count noses, they elect a Speaker, and then the Speaker organizes the House, and then everything flows from that.
Now, this was already going to be an interesting race to figure out who was going to be the Speaker of the House because Republican Speaker Dennis Bonin was highly praised during his time during the legislative session, but things didn't end so well. Can you remind us what happened there?
Well, he kind of stepped on his own tongue. He was talking to an activist named Michael Quinn Sullivan, who's with Empower Texans, which has been kind of an antagonistic conservative organization, you know, within the House, and was generally considered not a friendly to the Speaker and to his faction in the House. But they had a private conversation in which Bonin was talking about other Republican members of the legislature and seemed to be scheming against them. The word of the meeting got out. Bonin denied it, but Michael Quinn Sullivan taped it, and Bonin ended up saying, I won't run for Speaker again, I won't run for the House again, so we've got an open seat.
So how does this Speaker election work? It's just the party kind of getting together and voting on who they want to represent them?
It's been more bipartisan than that, even with the parties in place. It doesn't work like Congress. It's the first member to get 76 votes, and it doesn't matter where they come from. So even in cases when we've had Republican speakers or Democratic speakers, they've generally only been able to get there with a little bit of help from the other party. And in the case of the Texas House this time, there are only an eight-seat margin separating them. And so a Republican speaker is going to need some Democratic votes. If the House flips, it'll probably only be by a couple of seats. And a Democratic speaker would probably only be elected with some Republican votes. So it's basically a high school senior class election at a higher level.
Interesting. Now, we are, you know, still a week out from the election. We don't know who all of the members are going to be, but many of those who are already elected there, again, have thrown their hat into the ring. What's that typically look like? And are we ahead or behind the eight ball when it comes to who's going to be seeking that seeker spot?
It's been a while since we thought the House would change parties. So you've generally gone into an election knowing that, you know, some members are going to be replaced and whatnot, but you still know that either the Republicans or the Democrats are going to be in the majority. What's unusual this time is that we don't know that. The Democrats are making a strong push to gain the majority. The Republicans are a little uncertain. And it's given everybody who might be interested in becoming Speaker a moment of hesitation. You know, you don't want to get too far out in front of it and then find out your party's not in the majority. A couple of Democrats have gone ahead and declared just in the last few days. Sophronia Thompson from Houston declared last Friday. And by declare, I mean they filed the papers with the Texas Ethics Commission that says, I'm beginning my speaker for the candidacy. And then this week, Trey Martinez Fisher, a Democrat from San Antonio, threw into the race. No Republicans are officially into the race yet, but there's a lot of chatter among the 150 members.
So what does that say about politics in Texas right now, that both the speaker candidates right now are Democrats?
It just says that the Democrats are optimistic at this point that they can get the 9 seats that they need to get the majority. That's not a given. That's going to be tough, even if they have a really good Democratic day. They're trying to improve by 9 seats on their 2018 performance, which was really unexpectedly great for them. The Democrats took 12 seats in 2018. So you can say that they're trying to improve by 9 seats, their best year in a couple of decades.
Now, I know there are a lot of unknowns in this election, a lot of people with like complete mistrust of polls still after 2016. But based on what we know now on those polls, on money being spent in Texas, on early voting turnout, do you have any predictions for us right now for next Tuesday?
Not really. I think, what you can say about Texas that you haven't been able to say in previous elections is this is competitive all the way from the top of the ballot down to the bottom. And both of the parties have put up serious candidates in races where in past years they just said, well, the other party's going to get this. We're not going to put somebody serious in this race. And I think, from the presidential race through the Senate on down through the courts, the legislature, that both sides are really vying for this one, and that the race is close enough and the turnout is big enough that it could kind of go either way.
Ross Ramsey is executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Thank you so much, Ross, and hope you get some rest between now and Election Day.
I kind of doubt it, but it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Wells, Dunbar is keeping track of what Texans are talking about on social media. Wells, what's the big story today?
Hey, Laura. Well, we're hearing from folks about the topic at hand, the potential toss-up in the Texas House. Via Twitter, Donna says, I think Texas has been turning towards becoming more progressive for a little while. And indeed, Laura, moving from state house politics to the national election, lots of folks on Twitter agog at a move from NBC News, moving Texas from leans Republican into the toss-up category. Quite the development there. And that news, I should say, underscored by some other reports I'm seeing on Twitter today that former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg is sinking $15 million into bilingual attack ads on President Trump set to air in Ohio and, you guessed it, Texas. So obviously lots of folks increasingly seeing the state in play on election night. Well, speaking of election night, the Supreme Court inauguration of Amy Coney Barrett and the potential for a Supreme Court ruling this election certainly sparking a lot of discussion on social media. We have several comments coming in from our friends and listeners on our Facebook page and Twitter, and I'll be back with some of those responses later in the show.
Let us know what's on your mind. Join the conversation on social media or send us an email, texasstandard@kut.org. We'll hear from Wells again in about 35 minutes.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. We lost a pioneer in U.S. Spanish language broadcasting this past weekend. Irma Nicolas died in her hometown of San Antonio on Saturday. She was 88. Texas Public Radio's Jan Ross Piedad has more on her life and legacy.
Born Irma Alicia Cortez, her father Raul Cortez started KCOR-AM in San Antonio in 1946.
As Mexican Americans, we were discriminated, and this is why my father took it very serious about the Spanish radio and television to educate our own people.
His radio and television stations were among the first full-time Spanish language broadcasters in the U.S. and the first to be Hispanic-owned and operated.
They should defend themselves, and the airwaves are ours.
That's Nicolas in a 2012 interview with the University of Texas at Austin's Voces Oral History Center. In a speech to the National Association of Broadcasters in 2006, Nicolas recalled her experience working at the station.
It was my pleasure as a young lady to have worked with my father as his Girl Friday. I loved selling $5 spots on the radio to husbands that wanted to serenade their wives and mothers on Mother's Day.
she carried her father's legacy forward. In the 1960s, Irma and her husband Emilio Nicolás built the TV station into an operation center for the Spanish International Network, which later became Univision. The pair became the media power couple of their day. Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, founder and director of the Voces Oral History Center, says Irma and Emilio's partnership was key to their success.
She encouraged him, she promoted him, she pushed him. She was the touch of class in every place that he went. She was always at his side, and that's not a small thing.
Emilio Nicolás died last October, also at the age of 88. The family sold its stake in the Spanish International Network in 1987. In a tweet Sunday, Roberto Yanez, president of Univision Local Media in New York, said the Univision family mourned her passing, calling Nicolás an Univision founding member. The Nicolás family also has a strong philanthropic legacy in San Antonio. One example, Texas Public Radio now broadcasts from the Irma and Emilio Nicolás Media Center downtown.
De mi padre a mi marido. Y estoy muy emocionada y muy contenta.
That's Nicolás at the building's groundbreaking in 2019, where she was guest of honor. During an interview with Univision, she became emotional while talking about her family's legacy. Nicolás is survived by 3 children and their spouses, 5 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren. I'm Jen Ross Piedad in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. On Election Day, members of the Texas Army National Guard will be in the streets of certain Texas cities. That's according to reporting Monday that the order came from Governor Greg Abbott. The troops are said to be in place in case of any disturbances that arise from the November 3rd election, but there are a lot of questions about where exactly they'll be and what they'll be doing. Here to help us get some answers is Sig Christensen. He covers veterans and the military for the San Antonio Express News. Sig, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Laura.
How many troops are we talking about here, and which cities are they going to?
Well, the soldiers, and I think they will all be soldiers, will be going to Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, and San Antonio. There's 1,000 in all, but we asked and did not get a breakout of how many go to each city.
So what have you been told that they'll be doing? What's their purpose?
Well, the governor is the person who would be answering that question. There are a couple of things here. First, the guard didn't exactly say what is their purpose, other than what General Brown said. I've known him a long time, and he's a straight shooter. And he said that what we're there for is to do what we did during the summer protests, which was, quote, to deter any civil disturbance at sites in various cities within Texas. Now, as I say, we don't know what kind of intel is afoot here. We don't know what they apparently know about the potential for violence or disturbances. I can tell you that in talking with Judge Wolf, our Bexar County judge, he doesn't seem to have any intel on that either. So we don't really know what the problems are that the guard is anticipating. That's just one thing that we don't really have answers to. And I'll make it very clear. The reason we don't have answers is because the governor did not respond to our list of questions. We had 9 in all, and I called the person on the phone, left a message, as well as sent an email to her. Never heard back.
General James Brown, there you mentioned, is chief of staff to the Texas National Guard's commander. So, Sig, do we know that these troops might be dispatched to the polls, or do we even have any idea of that yet?
Well, they're saying that's not what they're here to do, but they also did not rule it out. General Brown made it very clear that at this point they're supposed to go and be out at places like the Alamo or the Texas Capitol. But beyond that, we have no idea. The Alamo is the most likely place because it's such a symbol. Mm-hmm. But and it's also a place where agitated people tend to go to express their views. So I can guess we will see soldiers there, but where else we'll see them, I couldn't tell you.
Now, they're using the protests earlier this year as sort of their precedent. But is there a precedent, a routine function of the National Guard that is getting more attention this election cycle? Is this something we've seen National Guard troops do before at all?
Well, Nelson Wolf, who has lived here for 70 years and turns 80 years old today, told me yesterday that he could never remember the Texas Guard being used to protect polling places. I cannot remember that, ever. So if they were to do that, it would be most likely an unprecedented action, and it raises a lot of questions. And in the minds of voters, not everyone would see that as a reassuring action. So it's a controversial move if it ends up being done. But as we've heard so far, that's not in the cards. Although, I will stress again that when I asked General Brown about this, I asked if it was possible that the Guard's mission might change to include polling sites. He said, quote, "We never make any speculation associated with any possible mission. That's not what we do. We respond to requests from the governor." Now, that means that the governor could order them to do it. And the governor is the commander-in-chief of the Texas National Guard. He's the boss. And he can tell them to go wherever he wishes them to. So that's something to keep in mind. They're saying that's not something they're planning. However, it is certainly not out of the realm of possibility.
A lot of questions surrounding this, and Sig Christensen has been trying to get answers. He covers veterans and the military for the San Antonio Express News. Sig, thank you again.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. To aid early detection, all women over the age of 40 should undergo routine screening, like yearly mammograms. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas Republicans are applauding the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court, solidifying the court's conservative majority. Senator Ted Cruz addressed reporters last night after he and 51 other Republicans voted to approve Barrett's nomination.
The Republican majority in the United States Senate delivered on one of the principal promises we made to the American people, to confirm principled constitutionalists to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Fellow Texas Senator John Cornyn also voted to confirm Barrett. Election Day is 1 week from today, and already more than 7.8 million Texans have voted early. The last day of early voting for the 2020 general election is Friday. An ongoing study from UT Southwestern Medical Center and Texas Health Resources looking at where COVID-19 is spreading in North Texas and why some groups are hit harder is now seeking volunteers. KERA's Miranda Suarez explains previous participation was by invitation only.
Researchers conducting the DFW COVID-19 prevalence study have tested more than 2,000 people, but they want tens of thousands. They need big numbers to be able to break down how COVID-19 is affecting specific racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. Jasmine Tiro is a co-investigator in the study.
We're seeing a disproportionate burden of our minority populations experiencing more serious COVID disease. They're more likely to be hospitalized. They're more likely to die from this disease.
Researchers are looking for 30,000 Dallas and Tarrant County residents to participate. They also have an additional 14,000 slots for frontline workers, like teachers and retail employees. The study comes as a recent analysis from UT Southwestern found that hospitalizations in North Texas are on the rise, and infection rates are up for all age groups. I'm Miranda Suarez in Fort Worth.
The Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission is launching a new training course for alcohol delivery drivers. The agency's executive director, Bentley Nettles, says the online certification will help couriers comply with state laws, such as carding customers and recognizing dry or damp counties where alcohol is more restricted.
So if you go to the door to deliver it, nobody shows up, or a teenager shows up, what do you do? And it walks them through that process to verify it and take it back to the company in which they took it from for delivery.
The two-year certification can be completed through TABC's website. The state legislature last year approved third-party alcohol deliveries by companies such as Favor and Uber Eats. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. The label fake news is used so often these days it almost doesn't mean anything anymore. But false political news stories are a real thing, and many seem to be especially targeting Spanish-speaking voters ahead of this election. The false stories and conspiracy theories are spreading on popular social media platforms like WhatsApp that are frequently used by the Latino community. And one of the goals of the misinformation campaign seems to be pitting Latino voters against Black voters. Patricia Mazzei has been writing about this for the New York Times, where she's the Miami bureau chief. Patricia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What kinds of conspiracy theories are gaining the most traction among Latino voters?
There have been many, just like there have been in English, but the ones we have seen in Spanish, especially in South Florida, have often been trying to pit Latinos against Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter movement. What we have seen here that is especially worrying is that some of these conspiracy theories that begin online and are shared on social media eventually seep into the mainstream media, into Spanish language radio, for example. And so you could have a host, as we saw last month, discuss a conspiracy theory about a co-founder of Black Lives Matter practicing witchcraft or devil worship based off of a conspiracy theory on a website, but then spreading that to thousands of listeners on the radio and extrapolating from that to say that people who support Black Lives Matter do not support police, do not believe in law enforcement, and are not religious in terms of, you know, they're not trustworthy. And so they sort of take that to eventually say, don't vote for Joe Biden because you are voting for these people.
And we mentioned these are especially happening on platforms such as WhatsApp that are popular with Spanish speakers, you know, people who have come from other countries, because WhatsApp is huge almost everywhere else in the world and less so here in the United States, except among many of these Spanish-speaking communities. What are the challenges of shutting down misinformation on a platform such as this as compared to, you know, say, Twitter or Facebook?
Well, it's one of those things psychologically where if somebody who you know, like your cousin or your friend, shares something with you, you tend to trust it more because mm-hmm. you have a relationship with that person. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of relational disinformation or misinformation is very hard to fight back. WhatsApp says that it has been trying to take steps, you know, pairing up with fact checkers to try to stop some of this from spreading, but it's an encrypted messaging system. You can create groups of, you know, 200 people on there and very easily forward a link or a video to spread it with all those other people. So it is hard to stop misinformation from bubbling up and then quickly spreading. Like you said, this has happened in other countries, in Brazil, in India, in Mexico. And now it seems to be happening here in Spanish. Often it's sort of a cross borders effect where something might originate outside the US and then come to the US and then flow back to another country or vice versa. So it's just very hard to trace.
Are they coming from all sides or do they seem to be favoring one party over the other?
What the scholars who have studied this have found is that it has come mostly from right-wing Spanish language websites. They're designed to look like nonpartisan news outlets, and the liberal activists and experts have struggled to keep up with a response because they don't always know what's spreading in these private closed groups, and also because there are language barriers. If you're not closely checking or monitoring some of these Spanish language news sites. You don't have enough people to do that. You don't know what is being said until, for example, it is said on the radio.
We've been following this, especially in South Florida, but it sounds like the nature of, you know, a social media app means that it can and will go everywhere.
Yes. I mean, there was some of this in 2016 in Arizona, for example, in Spanish and among Hispanic voters. And there is the scholars found that they tried to deter Black voters in 2016 through some social media campaigns this way. But it's just gotten exponentially worse. The scale of the misinformation and the baseless claims have just gotten more and more wild. And so that's what has been really stunning about the 2020 campaign cycle.
Patricia Mazzei is the Miami bureau chief for the New York Times. She's been writing about the rapid spread of false political news among Latino voters. Patricia, thank you again.
My pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork. You're listening to the Texas Standard. My name is Marcy Hanna. I'm the author of the Fireside Texas series. When We Last Spoke has been turned into a major motion picture. I was born in Austin, Texas, and have been here for most of my life. But when I was in high school, we lived in Johnson City on the family ranch. And on that ranch were my grandparents, who lived in one house, and we lived about a mile down the road in another home. And we're very, very close to my grandparents, so that when they passed, I missed them, and I wanted to do something to record the way they spoke, their pastimes, and just ranch life. And that really was the seed that began the Fireside Texas series. The story itself is completely fiction. There are real moments, though, that I use to ground it, to make it seem real and for fun. And those can be seen throughout the movie as well. The way I got started in the movie business was that when I wrote When We Last Spoke and was about to publish it, I decided to make a book trailer, which is a lot like a movie trailer. It was a cutting edge thing to do at the time because I'd only seen one. I'd seen it on Facebook. I didn't know what I was doing, but it worked out just fine. Books and films are kind of different animals. There's so much narrative in a book, and you can spend pages and pages describing something that takes about 2 seconds in a movie to show. So a lot of, kind of slicing and dicing has to happen. We were so blessed because we had an amazing cast. Cloris Leachman plays Itasca in the movie, and she was a blast to work with. She's just as funny in person as she is on camera. She steals every scene that she's in. And we have Melissa Gilbert from Little House on the Prairie. Everybody knows Melissa. We all remember her from growing up, and she's still quite present and such a professional, wonderful person to work with on camera. And we have two young stars. All these folks just did a brilliant job. I love small towns. There's so much that resonates with me about them. Some of that had to do with the daily life, which is more connected not only to the present, but also to our past. There are many ways of going about doing things that are quite traditional and have been taught from generation to generation, whether that be having a beautiful garden, it could be quilt making, it could be canning, it can be philosophies. There's just so much richness there. We have a couple messages in this movie. One is, you've got to forgive others before you can move on. And another message, which is important to me, is that in whatever situation you find yourself, whatever you're, you know, going through in life, you've got to dance where you are, dance in the situation, because if you wait until things are perfect, you're going to be waiting for a long time. My name is Marcy Hanna. I'm the author of the Fireside Texas series and of When We Last Spoke, which is now a major motion picture. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Though we've already seen a record number of early voters in Texas, others are still undecided about who they'll choose for president. Research earlier this year showed Latinas were five times less likely than Hispanic men to know who they're voting for. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval spoke to some undecided Tejana voters to find out why.
Maria Cristina Manrique de Henning still isn't sure who she'll choose for president.
It's funny because my friends, they are like, what? How can you not know?
Manrique de Henning spoke to me on the phone from her Houston home. She runs a nonprofit to help Venezuelans, her home country she immigrated from nearly two decades ago. In 2016, she voted for Hillary Clinton, but now she's leaning towards President Donald Trump.
Both elections have been like an awful experience for me as a new voter.
She doesn't like Trump, but sees his administration as good for business, anti-abortion, and she likes their stance on Venezuela.
And one of the things that I think made a big push was the recognition of Juan Guaido.
In early 2019, Trump recognized Juan Guaido as president when Venezuela's legislature voted him in, though leftist leader Nicolas Maduro remains in power. In the U.S., Manrique de Henning considers herself center-left. She says she'll vote for Congresswoman Lizzie Pannell Fletcher, a Democrat, but she's not sure about Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. She worries he'll raise taxes and about his mental acuity.
I watch sometimes Jaime Bailey.
He's a Miami-based Peruvian commentator who hosts a talk show about Latin American and U.S. politics.
I have seen a lot of the clips that he's shown that show Vice President Biden very aloof.
Like this snippet from a recent Bailey show.
La más gloriosa es esta.
A $15 million, or $15,000, $15 minimum wage. I'm dreaming here.
Se equivoca no una, pero dos veces.
Manrique de Henning's mindset is stick with the devil you know, but she's not certain. A poll of Texas Latino voters from the summer found that Latinas were five times more likely than Hispanic men to be undecided about the 2020 election. University of Texas political scientist Victoria De Francesco Soto says she thinks Trump's appeal and outreach to men may account for some of that.
We know that there is a gender gap and that one of the most reliable bases for Trump has been men. And even among minorities, it has been men.
She also points out, since that polling data came out, the Biden campaign has stepped up its outreach to Latinas, and more people have made up their minds. Still, a University of Houston Univision poll from September found 8% of Texas Latino voters were undecided. That's both men and women. Jasmine Mendeville is a first-time voter from North Houston.
I don't know what to do because I see the positives and negatives of both sides. And I think that's where I'm at when it comes to the election.
Mendeville's 19. She's studying to become a preschool teacher at a local community college and works at an Amazon warehouse. With all that, she admits it's hard to keep up with politics. The most important issue for Mendeville this election, neighborhood safety.
Well, I think I remember Biden saying something about when it comes to the police, to like have them more involved with the community members. And I thought that was a pretty good point. When it comes to people protecting us, like as a society, we shouldn't feel scared.
Her family isn't that into politics, she says. But this year, they've been paying closer attention, watching debates and speeches. Victoria De Francesco Soto says many Latino families come into elections with open minds.
Latinos tend to be historically more independent and more undecided. And that's for a whole host of reasons.
One being that first or second generation immigrant families don't have a strong party identity.
There's not that kind of long tradition of a party, you know, one side or the other.
Mendeville says her mom's friends have pressured their family to vote for Trump. Mendeville's own friends, though, are anti-Trump or undecided. I ask her what she thinks about the president, like how he handled COVID-19.
Maybe sometimes he would downplay it a little.
Mendeville says he should have done a better job at the start of the pandemic. She's hoping to do more research in the coming days and knows time's almost up before she'll have to make a decision. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Earlier this year, we marked the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. It bars discrimination and is supposed to allow for full participation for people with disabilities. The reality is that we're far from that place. And even in something so fundamental to American rights, voting, people with disabilities are often denied access. In 2014, a federal survey of polling places in Harris County found just 1 in 3 were accessible. Leonard Lane was part of that study and continues to push for accessible polls. He's an architect and a registered accessibility specialist. Leonard, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
What are the most common barriers to access you've found at polling places?
Usually the simplest things, an accessible parking space, a ramp and a curb to get up onto a sidewalk, doors that were too narrow to pass through in a wheelchair, very, very basic things that you would need to get to the polling area or room typically.
And I guess this happens because polling places can be, you know, government buildings or almost any place.
Well, yes. In Harris County, there are over 800 polling places on Election Day, and the vast majority of them are not government, in this case, county-owned. So in the precincts, they have to find a building that can be open to the public for polling Election Day, and it may or may not be even a commercial building.
Now, in Texas, the rules vary county by county, depending on, you know, where you have to vote in early voting and then where you have to vote on Election Day. And in some places, it's still required that you have to vote in your precinct. Can that be an extra burden or an extra problem for people with disabilities?
Yeah, well, it certainly can, especially, again, in Harris County with over 800. The county, after 2016, changed their system, and now anyone can vote at any polling place within the county.
So has accessibility in Harris County improved in the years since you were involved in this survey of its polling places?
I believe it has. Now, I have not been involved in any further investigations of the accessibility compliance in the county, but I know that with the change to allow people to vote at any location, that alone should have helped a lot of people in terms of being able to go to places they're familiar with that they may already be going to for other activities and knowing that they are accessible.
It seems to be that you've found that the access issues tend to be more physical to the building and less to the machines that people have to use. Can that also be a problem, though?
Every polling place is required to have at least one machine that can be used by persons with disabilities. And so I don't think that the machines themselves are the problem so much as getting access to the machines. And in the event that someone just cannot possibly get into the voting room, they also have portable voting machines that can be taken to curbside to allow someone who, for whatever reason, may not even be able to leave their vehicle to vote in privacy at their vehicle with this basically portable. It's more like a small laptop or iPad.
Are there things any Texan headed to the polls can check for to ensure ADA compliance? And what could they do if they notice a problem?
Well, I'd say the first thing to do would be to go online in your county, and they should have a website for voting information and information for specifically for disabled persons. And I know Harris County does, so you can find out what to expect and if there are concerns, how to contact voting officials in the county to make sure that when you arrive at a particular polling place that you know what to expect. The website says that if you're planning to use the curbside voting in particular, to notify the polling place in advance to give them an idea that you're coming and when so they make sure that it's available and they're looking for you. So there are things that can be done too online, and even for persons with, say, hearing disabilities, to get information in advance. And that's obviously something you want to plan on, regardless of whether you're disabled or able-bodied.
Leonard Lane is an architect and a registered accessibility specialist. He's been writing about pole access for people who are disabled as part of his work with Accessibility Professionals Association. Leonard, thanks again.
It's been my pleasure. You're very welcome.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Our social media segment is our modern letters to the editor, and social media editor Wells Dunbar tracks it all for us. Mm-hmm. Wells, what's the word?
Does that make me the postmaster? If so,
postmaster,
I accept the
general
position.
Yes.
All right. Well, this one has a lot of people talking. Obviously, the Senate voted 52-48, largely along party lines, to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Here we are, yes, just 1 week to Election Day and the inauguration of a new Supreme Court justice. Obviously, the talk of politics watchers online. Mm. On her Facebook page, John E. Davis says, "I know what I am qualified for and where I lack." He says it speaks volumes about Barrett's character that she accepted this nomination knowing she was vastly unqualified. And don't get me started on the hypocrisy of the GOP. They are without morals. I think referring to the lack of qualifications, I think referring there to her limited practice as a judge, I believe only 2 to 3 years. Meanwhile, Marcus Sengupta says that she is qualified. The objections have been quite hypocritical and contrary to primary American values regarding the opposition. Interesting comment here from Janice Smith. She says, "I'm still baffled that anyone continues to support the GOP. This took them 30 days to steamroll through as Americans are struggling through this pandemic, and we still haven't seen another relief bill passed. It's pretty clear where priorities are, and it's not the people." Craig Anders York says he's not thrilled, but we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, Rachel Zock says, "My thoughts about this are not fit for airing on public radio." So obviously a wide range of opinions out there, and I think I alluded to this earlier, lots of chatter online too about the role the Supreme Court could play when it comes to election night,
right?
How long the counting of mail-in ballots or absentee ballots will occur. Lots of people talking about this opinion from Judge Kavanaugh, newly installed on the Supreme Court as well,
right,
which basically called to halt the counting of absentee ballots relatively early as not to inspire a lack of confidence in the election system. So lots of people taking umbrage with that opinion from Justice Kavanaugh and wondering what the installation of this ninth justice just in time for the election on the Supreme Court, what that could do for our election results here in America.
You know, yeah, we're just in this time period, right? Of the voting is happening. People are letting their voices be known, and there's just little control that anybody has over anything right now. And so I think we're just all feeling this sort of spinning the wheels thing and asking questions that we don't know if we're going to have to answer or how we're going to have to answer them.
Exactly.
You know, I think it's interesting to hear from experts now and trying to get them on the record of like, well, what if we don't know who the candidate will be? What if this question and what if that question, mm-hmm. you know, can you commit now so that we know that that's not a partisan answer? But I don't know, you know, it's going to be
sneaky, sneaky. There you
very
go.
Interesting.
In media with your gotcha questions, Laura.
Is that what I'm doing? Oh, my goodness. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. Rhonda Fanning is our executive producer. Texas Standards producers include Joy Diaz, Jill Amick, Kristen Cabrera, Terry Langford, Michael Marks, Alexander Hart, Shelley Brisbane, and Caroline Covington. Thank you for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.